I've experienced hundreds of memorable concert and interview moments, so it's hard to rank them in any favorite order, but my final hours with John in New York are certainly on the short list. It was just weeks before his death in December of 1980, and his playing the summer record was an endearing greeting, and one that was typical of John. Of the hundreds of musicians I've met, John was among the most down-to-earth. I was in New York to spend 3 days with John and Yoko while they finished Double Fantasy, John's first record collection of new material since the mostly forgettable Walls and Bridges 6 years earlier. He returned to New York after the Lost Weekend period and spent the next 5 years rebuilding his life with Yoko and helping to raise their son, Sean. On this day, he looked nice and trim in jeans, a jean jacket, and a white t-shirt. He was maybe 25 pounds slimmer than the last time I'd seen him. "It's mother's macrobiotic diet," he said later, and employing his nickname for Yoko. "She makes sure I stay on it." By the time we headed to the recording studio, it was nearly dark. As a limo pulled up to the studio's dimly lit entrance, I could see the outlines of a couple dozen fans in the shadows. They raced toward the car as soon as the driver opened John's door. Flashbulbs went off with blinding speed. Without a bodyguard, John was helpless, and I later asked if he didn't worry about his safety. "They don't mean any harm," he replied. "Besides, what can you do? You can't spend all your life hiding from people. You've got to get out and live some, don't you?" Inside the studio, I heard several tracks from Double Fantasy, which was John's most revealing album since Imagine. Some critics branded the gentle, relaxed tone of the collection too soft. They missed the old Lennon bite. To me, however, the collection was a marvelous reflection of John's mood, and Grammy voters were right when they named it Album of the Year. I spent hours at the apartment in the studio talking to John about the changes since Los Angeles. He felt at peace for one of the few times in his life. He was deeply in love with Yoko and thrilled to be a father again. He also spoke with affection about the Beatles days and how much he still looked forward to seeing Paul. That surprised me because of the sarcastic barbs he'd launched in interviews and the biting lyrics he'd written about Paul since the breakup of the band. "Ah, don't believe all that," he said, smiling. "Paul's like a brother. We've gotten way past all that." He also spoke fondly of Ringo, but more distantly about George. He felt slighted by some things in George's autobiography, I Mean Mine, especially George's failure to give John credit for helping him learn guitar techniques. Mostly we talked about the house husband period that was just ending, a time of emotional drying out, a chance to reset priorities. He may have declared, "I don't believe in the Beatles, in God," on his 1970 album Plastic Ono Band, but it took the 5-year sabbatical that followed the Lost Weekend for him to break away from the suffocating pressures of being an ex-Beatle, including the need to mirror in his music and in his life the image of the witty, sarcastic John. During his time away, he learned that there was personal joy and fulfillment away from the rock and roll merry-go-round. For Double Fantasy, he even wrote a tender song about his newfound outlook and freedom, Watching the Wheels. On that November night, the studio atmosphere was so relaxed that John invited me to contribute to the album's sound effects. Yoko and I took turns dropping coins into a tin bowl to duplicate the sound of someone giving change to a beggar. We had to do it several times before the noise level was just right. For most of the evening, I just watched John and Yoko at work and took advantage of breaks to ask them questions. The studio tape must have been running much of the time because years later a bootleg of that interview surfaced in Japan. One thing troubled me during the all-night recording sessions, the way John would slip in from time to time to an adjoining lounge. The first thing that came to mind was drugs, because I was so used to seeing musicians pass around bowls of cocaine with the casualness of M&Ms. John had had drug problems earlier in his life, and I feared he had relapsed despite all his talk about feeling healthier than ever. Maybe the pressure of being back in the studio was greater than he was letting on. At one point, I happened into the lounge and saw John at the far end of the narrow room. He was reaching for something on a cabinet shelf, and my first instinct was to go back into the studio so I wouldn't violate his privacy. But he spotted me and called me over, putting his finger up to his lips in a signal to be quiet. When I was next to him, he reached into the cabinet again and pulled out something wrapped in a towel. "Want some?" he asked. "Just don't tell Mother," he said with a more conspiratorial look. "She doesn't want me doing this anymore." As he opened the towel, I had to laugh. John Lennon's private stash turned out to be a giant-sized Hershey bar. He broke off a chunk for me and one for himself. Holding his piece in a toast, John smiled and said, "Good to see you again."